CrimeCon, the world's number one true crime event, is coming to London in June of 2021. Get inside the mind of serial killers. Learn from leading criminologists. Hear from the families and survivors. Meet your favorite true crime podcasters. Immerse yourself in forensic evidence and delve deeper into unsolved crimes. CrimeCon is the ultimate true crime weekend, partnered by Crime and Investigation. I will be there all weekend, so come and join me. Make sure you use the code MORBID for 10% off your ticket at crimecon.co.uk. Limited tickets are on sale now, so make sure you get yours ASAP. If you use my code, let me know and I'll make sure to buy you a beer over there. Forever Has Fallen is a new podcast thriller that has lit up social media. There's a bunch of people now thinking digital immortality is real and available now. This shows you how detailed and well-produced Forever Has Fallen is. You have an amazing story about a tech billionaire on the run, and if you want more, you can participate in the action by becoming a bounty hunter. It's like a network of digital escape rooms for you to play with friends. So check out foreverhasfallen.com or click the link in my show notes. Listen on all major podcast platforms and sign up as a bounty hunter. I promise you, you'll have never seen anything quite like it. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Shortly after 2:15 a.m. on the 5th of February 2015, police in Bourne, Massachusetts, received a flurry of phone calls reporting a car that was up in flames at the Monument Beach condominium complex on Roadhouse Road. When they arrived at the scene and discovered the burning car, they weren't prepared for what they would find next. Soon enough, a routine call turned deadly. When police arrived at the scene, they discovered a car fully engulfed in flames and blocking the only road in and out of the Monument Beach condominium complex, which was situated along a tree-lined circular road. Unbeknownst to the officers, shortly after the 911 calls reporting the fire were placed, another 911 call had come in from a woman who lived on Roadhouse Road.
Please, 911, this line is recorded. Do you know who shot you?
Yes. His last name is Loya. He shot both of us, me and my wife.
What?
His last name is Loya.
Is he related to you?
No, he's from the Coast Guard.
He's in the Coast Guard?
Yes.
Ma'am. Okay, we got a report of a gunshot victim. Two of them and a female on the phone is passing out. Unknown on the male. Last name is Loya.
Is there anything on the gun?
Negative. Just a name. And Lawyer, the one who shot you, where's he at?
I don't know. Why are you taking so long?
We're on our way there, ma'am. We're right down the street. There's a car fire there. We got to move the car out of the way to get to you.
Please hurry up.
We're right down the street, ma'am. We're on the road right now.
Can you come back? He might come back for me, please.
He's not going to come back. We have plenty of officers in the area.
Screaming and gunshots can be heard before the woman tells the dispatcher that she and her wife had been shot by somebody in their condominium. As the officers approached the burning vehicle on foot, they were met by a flurry of gunfire. Officer Jared McDonald was shot in the back, just below his bulletproof vest.
I knew I had been shot almost instantaneously. I heard the gunshots. I recognized the sound. For a split second, I lost track of everything, but regained it quickly enough that I felt myself hit the ground. My right leg didn't work at all. I had a strange feeling throughout my body. So as quickly as possible, I pulled myself with my hands back behind the car.
He managed to cover between two vehicles, but the officers were pinned down by the gunfire and his colleagues were unable to reach him. Nearby, it was noticed that there were several devices which looked like bombs. Fear immediately washed over the responding officers. They were trapped in a very dangerous situation. As Bourne Police Chief Dennis Woodside said, it was an ambush. This guy set the whole scene up. This was an ambush on the cops. The burning car was strategically in the middle of the road, preventing police or emergency services from approaching the condominium where the shooting had occurred. As Officer McDonald lay wounded, the other officers exchanged gunfire with the suspect, who by this point they had deduced was a male. He was heavily armed with two long rifles, a shotgun, and a 9mm handgun. Unable to reach the two victims inside the apartment or Officer McDonald, help was called in from Massachusetts State Police, Falmouth Police Department, and Barnstable County Sheriff's Office. As the officers responded to the scene, the flurry of gunfire escalated. At around 2:48 a.m., the suspect was finally arrested after he put his firearms on the ground, walked into a well-lit area, and lay down on the ground. Still fearing that the devices could explode at any moment, a number of officers rushed to Officer McDonald and carried him through the woodland to safety. From here, he was taken by ambulance to Bourne High School, where he was loaded onto a med flight helicopter and taken to Rhode Island Hospital, where he survived. The State Bomb Squad were called to the scene, and after careful examination, it was determined that the devices, which looked like bombs, were fake and contained no explosives. After the scene was secured, police made their way to the unit where they discovered two women who had been shot inside their apartment. They were identified as 31-year-old Lisa Trubnikova and 30-year-old Anna Trubnikova. Tragically, Lisa was pronounced dead at the scene. She had sustained numerous gunshot wounds to her legs and her torso. Anna had also sustained gunshot wounds, but was still alive. She was rushed to Rhode Island Hospital. The suspect was identified as 31-year-old Adrian Loya of Virginia. He was charged with murder, armed assault, home invasion, and assault and battery of a police officer, and pleaded not guilty to all of the charges. A judge ordered him to be held without bail and to undergo a psychiatric evaluation. His attorney, Drew Segadelli, said that there was some kind of relationship between the two victims and Adrian, but he refused to elaborate any further. It would later be revealed that the two victims and Adrian were colleagues. They had all worked for the Coast Guard. Lisa and Anna were stationed at Joint Base Camp Cod at the base in Woods Hole, while Adrian was stationed in Portsmouth, Virginia. Adrian was an information technology specialist, while Lisa and Anna were both petty officers. Following Adrian's arrest, His interview by police had been recorded, and he made a full confession.
I just want to let you guys all know, I'm not going to lie at any point. I'm going to tell all the truth.
Okay.
So I'll go. I can go through point to point to point to point.
Yeah.
So I know I'm already a dead man, all this stuff.
Do you have an idea of what you did tonight?
Yes, sir.
And what was it that you did?
I murdered a woman.
And the way that you were going to murder her was how?
The initial plan was to do the breach with the shotgun. And through that, you know, during the middle of the night, that should scare them, provide fear that I had during that night at her house. And then go up there. I didn't want to touch Anna at all. And I considered total innocent. I had a knife on me, on the belt, and I wanted to use that to do a, you know, some kind of quick. I didn't want anything gruesome, but as far as I knew, be straight to the heart.
So you were going to take the knife and put it into her chest?
Correct.
And you just said put it into her heart?
Correct. Okay. But that didn't happen.
Okay. What did happen?
The cat actually kind of a good cat. The cat came and pounced on me, and that's when I opened the door to the room and they were there.
What happened when you opened the door up to the bedroom?
Well, I yelled, hell, you guys would yell, get down, get down, get down, face down, hands up.
Okay, and what are they doing?
Well, they screamed and did not comply. That's when they threw the mattress up.
Okay. What was your thought process then?
I had to complete the mission, which was terminate the mission.
You discharged the firearm?
Right.
And where did you discharge it to?
In the direction that I knew Lisa was underneath the mattress.
Okay. And did the discharge of the firearm, did it strike her?
I heard the burglar noises.
And what was Anna saying during this time?
I don't think it was words, it was just screams.
How do you feel right now about everything?
I didn't see the immediate aftermath. I just know I took a life, but it was a life I wanted to take. Job's done.
According to attorney Segadelli, Adrian had been in the process of transitioning out of the military and into civilian life. The Coast Guard put out a statement which read, "Today, the Coast Guard family suffered a tragic loss. We have chaplains and counselors on site and to support friends and families affected by this crime. My thoughts and prayers are with everyone who has been touched by today's sad event." The following day, it was announced that Anna would survive her injuries, while the Coast Guard thanked the Bourne Police Department for their speedy response, adding that they had saved the life of Anna and removed the threat from the community. Officer McDonald's family also released a statement saying that he faced a long recovery after sustaining a fractured vertebrae, but said that he was in good spirits and doing well. It soon became even more apparent that this had been a premeditated attack. Around 2 months before the attack, Adrian had made an online booking at the Quality Inn off the Bourne Rotary, which was in view of the State Police Barracks. Shortly before the attack, Adrian drove from his home in Virginia and checked himself in at the hotel, providing his credit card and driver's license, raising no suspicions. According to the staff members who had seen Adrian or spoken with him during his stay, there was absolutely nothing in his appearance, demeanor, or interaction that raised any cause for concern. Following his arrest, the room that he had rented was searched by investigators who discovered a rifle case and several empty boxes of ammunition, as well as directions to the hotel from Adrian's home. In Adrian's home, investigators also discovered a discipline letter, rifle magazines, non-lethal explosives similar to flashbangs, and range targets. They also seized 2 computer hard drives, SIM cards, and an Xbox. According to the search warrant, Adrian had told police that he left thumb drives, letters, and emails at his home, which indicated that he had reported that he had been assaulted by the victim. However, it was unclear as to whom Adrian had been referring to. Lisa and Anna had moved into the condominium on Roadhouse Road from Alaska around a year earlier. The couple had been living in Alaska while they were both stationed at Kodiak. According to their neighbours, they mostly kept to themselves, but that changed when they got a Yorkshire Terrier. A number of their neighbours fondly recalled that everybody wanted to pet their dog and got to know the couple when they were out walking their dog in the neighbourhood. Lisa and Anna were quiet, polite and friendly. As Anna's friend, Lena Nadia Lavoni, said, she had never heard Anna say a bad word about anybody. In her spare time, Anna loved to express herself through her photography and had a Facebook page devoted to her photographs. According to friends, the couple truly lit up any room they walked into, and they were a perfect match. They had met in February of 2011 through mutual friends. When they first met, they hit it off immediately. As Anna said, when she met Lisa, she felt as though she could finally be herself, and she wasn't afraid to be gay in a military setting anymore. The relationship moved quickly, and they were married in New York in front of their friends and family the following year. At the time, Don't Ask, Don't Tell had been finally lifted, but the military didn't recognize their marriage until the following year. At the time of the attack, the couple had been considering starting a family. As mentioned earlier, Adrian had been stationed in Portsmouth since June of 2013. Before that, he had been stationed in Juneau and Kodiak in Alaska. This made many people wonder if somehow Adrian and Lisa and Anna had crossed paths in Kodiak, where they had all been stationed at the same time. As it would soon be discovered, this was the case. According to a family member of Lisa, Adrian had been pursuing Lisa for years. This started back in Alaska when all three had been stationed at the same base. The unidentified relative said to the New York Daily News, he became obsessed. He was fixated on her. It was said that after Lisa and Anna were married, Adrian's obsession only intensified. On Tuesday morning, Adrian was back in court where a court-appointed psychologist said that she did not have the information she needed for an evaluation, including medical records and police interviews. The judge subsequently sent Adrian to Bridgewater State Hospital for an evaluation to determine competency and criminal responsibility. During this hearing, attorney Segadelli admitted that his client knew Lisa and Anna, but claimed that there was no proof of the allegation that Adrian was obsessed with Lisa. Following the attack, GoFundMe accounts were set up for both Officer McDonald and Anna. They both had a long recovery ahead of them, as well as psychological trauma from what they had been subjected to. Furthermore, Anna especially had the grief of losing a loved one. Officer McDonald needed to be transferred to a rehabilitation facility for his swelling to be brought down and for therapists to work on him so that he could stand for an x-ray in preparation for his upcoming surgery. Officer McDonald had a wife, Kerry, and two children who were at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. They had all been rallying around Officer McDonald and trying to make him as comfortable as possible. He was still unable to eat and was in a lot of pain, but had been able to sit up in a chair for several hours while wearing a restrictive back brace. A fundraising event had also been scheduled for Officer McDonald, named A Night for Jared. It would be featuring dinner and entertainment from bands that would be fronted by local firefighters. They would also be selling t-shirts with the number 7 emblazoned on the front, which was Officer McDonald's badge number, as well as the quote, "It was one bad day, tomorrow will be better," which was what Officer McDonald told his wife while being admitted to the hospital. When Officer McDonald was taken to the rehabilitation hospital, scores of law enforcement officials from Massachusetts and Rhode Island formed a blue honor guard from Providence to Boston, where he was checked in to the Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. According to Bourne Police Chief Dennis Woodside, the escort was spontaneous for the most part. He said, "As you can imagine, emotions are running high now. It all kind of just happened. The word must have got out there." In mid-February, Officer McDonald gave his first interview since the shooting and said that he had quite a road ahead with his recovery and said that he was in quite a bit of pain. He said that he had slowly been regaining movements in his right foot and had been able to put more weight on his leg, enough that he was able to take steps with the aid of a walker. He also said that he was unable to talk about the shooting, but wanted to thank the community for the outpouring of support. He told the Cape Cod Times, "You've got to deal with it and move on. This is just another stepping stone in our life. Certainly, it's a big step, but we'll tackle it together." The attack had left a dark cloud over Bourne. This was a quaint neighbourhood where people looked out for each other, and Lisa and Anna were nothing but jovial and reserved. According to neighbours, while they were shocked by what had happened, they were not afraid, because it had become evident that this was a targeted attack as opposed to a random one. In the wake, Barnstable County Sheriff James Cummings wrote a letter to the region's legislative delegation, which highlighted the need for a trauma centre on the Cape. As mentioned earlier, Officer McDonald had to be flown to Rhode Island Hospital, while Lisa had to be taken by ambulance. The Rhode Island Hospital is the only Level 1 trauma centre in southeastern New England and is the one closest to the Cape. In a letter, Sheriff Cummings said that he would be seeking help in bringing a trauma centre to the Cape. He said, "Needless to say, many patients requiring critical, life-threatening measures can be in jeopardy under such circumstances." While Adrian was being held at Bridgewater State Hospital for his evaluation, a number of his neighbours on Shoal Creek Trail spoke with the media to give some semblance of a picture of Adrian. They said that he could be heard playing video games, essentially all night. He was intensely private and would never say hello to his neighbours if they ever crossed paths. When he wasn't at work, he stayed indoors. While he had a fire pit and a grill in his garden, not one neighbour could ever recollect seeing him sitting outside. One neighbour, Kareem Cheeks, said, "I never said two words to him. I'd only see him coming and going. That's it. He never made eye contact with us." Kim Pimento, a property manager who was renting the townhouse to Adrian, was completely stunned when she saw Adrian on the news. She told reporters that she never found Adrian to be strange or dangerous. She said that he was a little shy, but was really nice, and he kept his home exceptionally clean and in order. In the beginning of March, Officer McDonald left the Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital, accompanied by a profusion of police vehicles. By this point, Anna had already left the hospital, and she took part in the procession alongside other Coast Guardsmen and women. Finally, some more information regarding the case was publicized shortly thereafter. It was revealed that shortly before Adrian left the Quality Inn in Bourne to drive down to the condominium complex, he had written a 250-page manifesto stating his reasons for killing Lisa. He wrote that Lisa was his sole target. The contents of the manifesto were not initially released. It was also revealed that following Adrian's arrest, he had told Detective John Doble that he had known Lisa for a couple of years and knew where she was living. He said that based upon a prior interaction he had with Lisa, he had made up his mind that he was going to barge into her house and kill her. He additionally said that he picked that specific date because it was his 31st birthday. The murder had been meticulously planned. The day before the shooting, Adrian had placed a digital game camera to a tree outside Lisa and Anna's residence and recorded their movements. On the morning of the shooting, Adrian had retrieved the camera and reviewed the images on a laptop in his car. He then parked his car sideways to prevent other vehicles from entering the road and lit it on fire with road flares and charcoal briquettes. Afterwards, he broke into Lisa and Anna's home. Wearing a black mask, he fired a shotgun at the front door lock to break in and went upstairs to the bedroom where he found the sleeping couple. He ordered both of them to stand up and open fire with a handgun. Even more disturbing, it was revealed that Adrian had been wearing a portable video camera attached to his chest when he committed the shooting. When investigators searched the crime scene, they found 15 spent casings from a 9mm handgun and a 9mm handgun magazine, a pair of handcuffs, a pair of safety glasses, as well as spent casings from a .22 caliber rifle and a spent shotgun shell. On the 15th of March, Lisa was laid to rest. Her funeral was held at the Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home in Midland, Texas, following which she was buried with full military honours at Rest Haven Memorial Park. The following month, the judge ruled that Adrian should remain in Bridgewater State Hospital for 6 months. His attorney commended the ruling and said that Adrian desperately needed the hospital's services, but said that it was still too early to speculate on whether or not they would be going for an insanity defense. He stated, "I wanted them to have him placed there. His psychological profile is one in need of the services provided by Bridgewater, and they continue with his evaluation." In May, there was a brief court appearance in Falmouth District Court, where the prosecutor and attorney Segadelli agreed to reschedule another hearing for the 16th of July. Then during the July court hearing, Adrian was formally indicted on 30 counts, which included murder, 10 counts of possession of a large capacity feeding device, 3 counts each of armed assault to murder, aggravated assault and battery, and use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, 2 counts of home invasion, armed assault in a dwelling, and armed kidnapping with serious bodily injury, 1 count of burglary and assault on an occupant, arson of a motor vehicle, possession of a hoax device, and assault and battery on a police officer. Adrian pleaded not guilty to all of the charges. Since you're listening to Morbidology, I don't doubt that you're a murder mystery fan. Well, today's episode is sponsored by the amazing mobile puzzle game, June's Journey. This is a free-to-download mobile game, and the objective is to find objects that are hidden within beautiful, colourful, and carefully crafted scenes. Even better, this game is set in the 1920s and has a real glamorous aesthetic and a diverse cast of characters. Each scene in the game will take you through a murder mystery, but along the way, you'll find yourself uncovering a number of secrets. What I really love about this game is that it's super therapeutic and even relaxing, but at the same time, it truly tests your observations and keeps your mind fresh. I especially like to play this game late at night before I go to bed. So go ahead and download June's Journey for free at the Apple App Store or Google Play, or click the link in my show notes. The following month, it was announced that Adrian had been found competent to stand trial. Judge Robert Rufo was presented with 2 evaluations that had been conducted at Bridgewater State Hospital. Psychologist David Holson said that in Adrian's current mental state, he was fit to stand trial and that he did not lack criminal responsibility for the shooting. Early the following year, attorney Segadelli asked for more time to prepare for trial. He announced that he planned on arguing that Adrian was not guilty by reason of insanity. He said that while Adrian had been found to be competent to stand trial and does not lack criminal responsibility, he said that this was relative to his current mental state, not his mental state at the time of the attack. He said that he had hired Dr. John Dignalt to conduct an independent evaluation, and said that the doctor's findings showed that Adrian was not guilty due to a mental illness or mental defect. Under state law, a person is not guilty by reason of mental illness if they are substantially unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of their actions or substantially unable to conform that conduct to the requirements of the law. The Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office announced that they would be hiring Dr. Martin Kelly Jr. to conduct their own independent evaluation of Adrian. Following the hearing, attorney Segadelli said that Lisa and Adrian had a friendship when they were both stationed at Kodiak. However, after Lisa got married to Anna, they apparently fell out. Outside of court, he said, "People moved on." In March, it was announced that Adrian would be standing trial on the 31st of May. However, the case would be pushed back several more times before finally going to trial in August of 2017. Shortly before it began, attorney Segadelli said, All too often, people of the general public look upon the insanity defence as the last outpost for the guilty man. However, in a case of this nature, it is a strong, legitimate defence. He additionally mentioned the manifesto that Adrian had written. Up until now, no information regarding the details of the manifesto had been released. Adrian had written that he wanted it to be clear that the murder was not the result of homophobia or a hate crime. Attorney Segadelli said it was more along the lines of revenge for past crimes. He revealed that in the past, Adrian had reported to the Coast Guard that he had been sexually assaulted by Lisa while they were both stationed in Kodiak. He said no more, but it was assumed that all of this information would be publicized during his upcoming trial. During opening statements of the trial, First Assistant District Attorney Brian Glennie described how Adrian blasted his way into the condominium of Lisa and Anna using a shotgun.
You hear that? He knew these two individuals, and they knew him, because he also was in the Coast Guard, and they had served together when they were stationed in Kodiak, Alaska. You hear that he was, at that point, basically demanding that they apologize and that they were profusely apologizing. You hear that this wasn't enough, though. You hear that he stepped from the room, and at that time, the two women grabbed a mattress that was on the bed in order to try to protect themselves, to hide behind. He came back in, and he shot 15 times from within him. 11 rounds of which were to enter the body of Lisa Trevino.
He mentioned the alleged sexual assault and said that after Adrian stormed into the couple's bedroom, he demanded an apology. Both Lisa and Anna apologized profusely and tried to protect themselves with their mattress, but to no avail. Adrian fired 15 rounds into their bedroom. 11 bullets hit Lisa, while 4 hit Anna, including 1 in the chest. The entire attack had been videotaped. D.A. Glennie told the jury that Adrian had set his car on fire and placed the phony explosives. He also played music from a boombox, which he had set up near the back of mailboxes at the condominiums. Turning to the jury of 9 women and 6 men, he said, "Battle tunes," as he would describe it. The prosecution had the burden of trying to prove to the jury that Adrian was guilty of the murder and was sane at the time. Adrian's attorney, Segadelli, on the other hand, would be arguing that while Adrian did plan and commit the attack, he was not guilty by reason of insanity. In his opening statement, attorney Segadelli said that Adrian may have been planning the attack for 16 months. During that time, he wrote his manifesto, and for the first time, it was revealed that he had sent Lisa a 23-page letter. He told the jury to expect testimony from mental health experts on both sides of the argument. The first witness to be called to testify was Officer Joshua Parsons. He was one of the first officers to arrive at the burning car. After they came under fire and were updated on the shooting of Lisa and Anna, they split into 2 teams to try and locate the victims. They had problems locating their condominium because the snow had buried the markers identifying the building numbers. Officer Parsons described how he came across what he believed was an improvised explosive device made of 2 soda bottles with wires. He had been searching for the condominium when he heard a radio transmission from Officer McDonald saying that he had been shot in the back and was hiding between 2 cars. He told the jury how after Adrian had surrendered, he appeared overly calm, especially when he was later being interviewed by police. He described how Adrian had been wearing multiple pairs of thermal socks, a thermal band around his torso, tactical gloves, knee pads and other winter and tactical gear. His pockets had been filled with ammunition. The jury also heard from Jameson Cornway, a man who lived in the condominium. He said that he looked out of his window that night and saw the car up in flames. He went outside to investigate and approached Adrian's car. He first of all wanted to determine that nobody was trapped inside the vehicle, and when he noticed that it was empty, he called police. Shortly after placing the 911 call, he heard a barrage of gunfire and heard a woman screaming, prompting him to return home. When back in his condominium, he heard loud music emanating in the neighborhood. He told the jury that first of all, it was loud heavy music before changing to symphony music. Following his testimony, State Police Sergeant William Qualls identified the boombox that the music had been emanating from. The boombox had flashbang and smoke grenades attached to it, as well as soda bottles fashioned to look like explosives. One of the most highly anticipated moments of the trial came when Officer McDonald testified. Over 2 years had passed since the shooting, but Officer McDonald continued to suffer from nerve damage and other injuries he had sustained in the shooting. He had since retired from the police force. He described how he was on patrol when he responded to a report of a car on fire at the Monument Beach condominium complex. He arrived and parked his patrol vehicle at the end of the road near the complex because the car was blocking the only entrance and exit. Shortly after he arrived at the scene, he was alerted to the shooting. He told the jury that he grabbed his rifle and asked the other responding officers to make sure that the road was blocked off. As he proceeded towards the car to try and ascertain where the victims who had been shot were, he heard somebody running through the woods. He attempted to cross a parking lot to get closer to a dumpster, which he planned on using as cover. He testified, "I was in a crouched position with a pistol and moving quickly with my knees bent. I did not make it."
As soon as I came out from behind the vehicle in a low tactical posture, I heard gunfire and was struck by a bullet. I didn't know where I was hit, but I knew I had been hit right away. I actually dropped to the ground right on the lower spine.
He managed to cover between two cars after he was shot in the back. He remained there until Officer Nathan Montero could safely come to his aid. He put Officer McDonald on his shoulder and carried him through the woods to safety. His testimony was bolstered by State Crime Lab chemist Amy Joy, who showed the jury the uniform that had to be cut from Officer McDonald as he was being flown by helicopter to the hospital. There was a clear bullet hole in the back. The other responding officers were called to testify as well. Born Police Chief Dennis Woodside and Police Sergeant Brandon Henson took the jury through the moment they found Lisa in Anna's condominium. Sergeant Henson said, "I saw a female riddled with bullets, face down, not breathing, in front of her closet." Chief Woodside said that when he first entered the bedroom, neither Lisa or Anna had a pulse. He found Anna lying on her side motionless with her phone rested on her ear from when she called 911. When he approached Anna, however, she made a low gasp and began to respond to his questions. He found that she had a handcuff attached to one of her wrists. A small dog was in a cage in the corner of the bedroom, unharmed. Both officers applied pressure to the most severe bullet wound that Anna had sustained in her chest while they waited for the ambulance to arrive. Paramedics first of all had to wait for the bomb squad before entering the condominium. After Adrian had surrendered to police, he was taken to Bourne Police Department where he was interviewed. A portion of the recorded interview was played out to the jury. Adrian spoke in a calm and collected manner and addressed the police officers as "Sir." He told Bourne detective John Doble that he had shot the women because Lisa had sexually assaulted him 2 years prior and had cost him a promotion. He said, "It's been 2 years since then, and I've obviously been severely, not mentally handicapped, but traumatized." He said that he got into trouble with the Coast Guard because there was no evidence that Lisa had sexually assaulted him, adding, "I've hated her since then." During the interview, Adrian had said that he anticipated and intended on police shooting him and killing him that night when he opened fire on them. In another chilling detail, which was revealed during the recording, Adrian had stated that he brought along a knife in his utility belt and had planned on using it to stab Lisa in the heart. He said that the attack had been meticulously planned, but when he first barged in to Lisa and Anna's bedroom, their cat pounced on him. He described how he had to place the cat outside of the bedroom before continuing the attack. he divulged more information regarding the alleged sexual assault. He claimed that one night in September of 2012, while Anna was away, Lisa invited him over to her home to watch movies. He claimed that when he got there, Lisa was drunk and she tried to kiss him. He claimed that after he turned on her advances, she started to masturbate in front of him, which made him feel uncomfortable. He said that Lisa went to her bedroom and he planned on leaving but heard a strange noise coming from the bedroom. He told police that he went to investigate because he was worried that she may have passed out from the alcohol. He claimed that Lisa then appeared at her bedroom door and pushed him onto her bed. He said that he had felt paralyzed. He told the officers that there was no intercourse, but described what had happened as a rape of his mind.
She asked me while I was there. I told her why.
And what did you say to her?
I told her, you know, here I am, this is what you did to me 2 years ago when you raped me. Even though it's not a physical rape, it was the, you know, basically a rape of the mind from a sexual attack.
He said that he wrote a letter to Lisa and Anna telling them what had happened and how he felt about it, and that Lisa became angry. He claimed that eventually he asked to be moved from his department because Lisa had made him feel uncomfortable. The Coast Guard investigated the incident, and they found that Adrian had abused his power as Lisa's superior, and that was what had cost him his promotion, not Lisa. They additionally doubted that any sexual assault had occurred, and recommended that Adrian pursue counselling. He said that the Coast Guard had turned on him and he stopped caring about his own life and whether he was dead or alive. This was when Adrian began planning the attack. Following the recorded interview, Jacob Heller testified. Jacob was a long-time friend of Adrian. He said that over the years, Adrian's obsession with Lisa had become extremely alarming. He said that first of all, Adrian spoke to him about how he really wanted to befriend Lisa and Anna. He confided in Jacob that he felt as though he and Lisa were a kindred spirit, and told him that he was trying to befriend her. However, over time, Adrian started to confide in Jacob that he wanted to become inappropriately involved in Lisa and Anna's relationship. Jacob said that at one point, he suggested to Adrian that he get professional help with his fixation on Lisa. He testified, "He seemed like he was coming to me for guidance, and I didn't have that guidance for him." Jacob also told the court that in September of 2012, Adrian told him that he believed that Lisa had made a sexual advance towards him and he refused it. He additionally said that Adrian told him that he believed that Lisa had led him on. When Jacob suggested to Adrian that he may have misconstrued her actions, he refused to listen. Under cross-examination of Jacob, attorney Segadelli tried to portray a picture of Adrian as an isolated man with very few hobbies and very few friends. Adrian wasn't close with his family and didn't speak to his father after blaming him for his dog being euthanized after becoming sick. According to Eli Horrigan, a correctional officer at the Barnstable County Correctional Facility, Adrian had been on suicide watch following his arrest when he told him the story of what had happened in September with Lisa. He said that after Lisa allegedly tried to have sex with him, he hired a sex worker to see if he could perform sexually. He told the officer that he had never enjoyed sex, aside from the beginning and the end, and that he had never developed a personal relationship with anybody. Dr. William Zane, the pathologist who conducted Lisa's autopsy, also testified during trial. He identified each bullet wound on Lisa's body and said that ultimately her cause of death had been two shots to her chest, which had struck her lung and her heart. He told the jury that Lisa most likely died within seconds. Arguably, the most emotional moment of the trial came when Anna took to the stand. She told the jury that she and Lisa had been asleep when she woke up to the sound of heavy stomping coming up their staircase and Adrian entering their bedroom.
I think I remember identifying like a flashlight because it was shining in our faces. And at some point I could see that it's a rifle of some sort. He threw handcuffs at us. He reached them from like the back of his gear. And he threw one to me first and threw to Lisa the other. And he directly spoke to her and said, in a very facetious way, you know what to do with them. Neither of us complied, and the last thing I wanted to be is restricted in that situation, so I refused to do it. He noticed that and was shouting and ordering more commands, saying, put them on. I put the handcuffs on my side on my right wrist, and I hid my left hand under some clothes or something, so that I could avoid not putting them on completely. He was talking to her most of that time that he was in the room. He mostly spoke to her. He said, actually shortly after he took the mask off, he said, and she kind of shouted his name, and he's like, see what you've done to me. You kind of like you're making me do this. Like this is what I've become type of because of you. And she was asking, what did I do? Or sorry. And he said, it's too late. Just a lot of repetitive things over and over. I mean, she would mostly say, I'm sorry, or why are you doing this? I don't know if he ever specified why, except saying that she did this to him and something about Kodiak.
Adrian yelled at the couple to separate and told Lisa that it was her fault that he was there. Both Lisa and Anna profusely apologized to Adrian and begged him not to shoot them. He threw handcuffs at the couple and told them to put them on. Anna said that she only put the handcuff on one wrist. When Adrian briefly stepped out of the room to move the couple's cat, Anna began to pull the mattress over herself and her wife.
I started to pull the mattress towards me, over me, and Lisa saw that, and she pushed it towards me from her side and jumped over now the empty bed side of it. So some of it was still on the bed, and she crawled over to my side of the bed, so we are now on the right side of the bed. He heard the ruffling. He reappeared and said, what do you think you're doing? Rushed towards us with the rifle, kind of tried to pull it off of us.
The mattress.
The mattress.
Go ahead.
But I, from what I remember, the mattress stayed covering the lower half of us, maybe a little less her than me because I was more into the corner that was tilted down. He was standing over us pretty close. I heard one shot out of the rifle. I don't remember seeing it, but I remember hearing it. But that was it. And I thought maybe it's a warning shot. Maybe seconds afterwards, there were more shots. I knew they weren't at me. I didn't feel it yet. The sound also went to my left. And at some point, there were more shots. And then I finally felt getting shot myself.
Adrian then re-entered the room and opened fire. Anna told the jury that after Adrian opened fire, she believed that she only had seconds left to live.
I figured we only have seconds after that to live. I turned to Lisa, I love you, to which she responded, I love you too. And we were very close. She was facing me, kind of, and I just turned my head towards her and I kissed her lips, and I remember the lips going numb, or not numb, limp, as if she got really weak. And right after that, I heard a lot of gushing blood, gurgling almost. And she started choking, like a wet cough, and exhaled, and it was a very deep exhale, and I, for myself, knew that she was dead at that point.
As Anna described Lisa's final moments on Earth, sobbing could be heard emanating in the courtroom. She said that Lisa died just moments later, and after she died, Anna noticed that Lisa must have phoned 911 at some point. She testified that she picked up the phone and started talking to the operator. She lay next to her dead wife for over an hour while waiting for the first responders and officers to arrive. The 911 call was played out during trial. On the call, Anna identified Adrian by his surname and said that she did not know his first name. She expressed fear that if first responders did not arrive soon, Adrian would come back and kill her. She whispered, "Please hurry up. I can't breathe." Anna said that she had met Adrian several times, the first of which was in early 2012, when a group of colleagues gathered at a bar to celebrate Lisa and Anna's marriage. She described him as awkward, but not socially awkward. She said that for a while, they had a strained relationship because Adrian kept expressing interest in Lisa. When she returned home from her training, Adrian had sent her an email claiming that Lisa had tried to have sex with him. Anna said that she was angry by the email and said that she and Lisa stopped seeing Adrian outside of work, but said that Adrian continued to text Lisa, sometimes late at night. She told the jury that she told Lisa to tell him that they were nothing more than friends, but she said that Adrian seemingly didn't understand that. The alleged sexual assault incident came under investigation by the Coast Guard, and both Lisa and Adrian received disciplinary letters. Adrian was transferred to Virginia, while Lisa and Anna were transferred to Cape Cod. They were told that if Adrian ever tried to contact them, to contact the Coast Guard. Following her testimony, State Police Trooper Jerry Donovan told the jury that after Adrian's arrest, they had discovered numerous computer files, documents, and videos outlining his plan to kill Lisa. They had been labelled things such as Loya Wars and the Wrath of Loya. In these documents, Adrian wrote about how Lisa's scent made him feel. There was a document labelled Operation Purple Rebel, in which Adrian wrote that he didn't want to harm Anna during the attack and wanted to keep her safe. He also told the jury that there was one video of Adrian titled PTSD, which showed him having a panic attack at the side of a Pennsylvania highway on his way home from Cape Cod after he planted a camera outside Lisa and Anna's home.
All right, I'm just... Boulevard on the side of the road. I'm having a panic attack. I started hyperventilating. I feel paralyzed. I can't move.
It was bad. My whole body was tingling. A weird tingling sensation. I realized I was getting into an accident. I wasn't able to totally control the car anymore. So I slowed down, pulled off the side of the road, turned on the hazards. And then that's when I started the video, because I knew this was big and people need to know about it. I guess also for my record, so I see what happens. This helped out a lot. Walk out. It's really pretty out here. Fucking gorgeous. Kind of here. I'm going to start heading to the car. So yeah, this is for myself. It's for the investigators. No more secrets like this. Thank you for listening.
Adrian's mental health was a focal point of the trial. Dr. Martin Kelly Jr. had interviewed Adrian after his arrest and concluded that he had Asperger's syndrome and is high functioning, but was experiencing a delusion when he planned to kill Lisa and when he carried the murder out. He deduced that Adrian saw himself as a tragic hero, righting a monstrous wrong in a battle between good and evil.
Is it your opinion that he did understand the wrongfulness of his acts?
He had the capacity to understand wrongfulness generally and had a capacity to know that it legally was criminal. He thought it was morally justified, well, given what had happened to him, but he did understand that to kill someone is against the law and to some degree morally wrong. Hence, he had to die as well.
Dr. Kelly believed that Adrian never had a crush on Lisa, but had an intense feeling for her in a positive way, but not a sexual way. Adrian had planned the attack meticulously, and he had anticipated that he would be killed by police. He had greased the floor of his home in anticipation of a police response and played the sound of ticking so that responding officers would think that there was a bomb somewhere in the house. He had also taken laxatives so that the person who found his body would not find him covered in feces. Upon entering the bedroom, Adrian had removed his face mask. According to Dr. Kelly, Adrian wanted Lisa to know that it was him and that he was there to seek moral vengeance for what she had done. He told the jury, in his mind, it's sort of avenging this monstrous thing that had been done to him. He concluded that although Adrian could differentiate between right and wrong and knew that what he was doing was wrong, he had a mental defect that prevented him from conforming his conduct to the law. Daniel Holtzen, a forensic psychologist at Bridgewater Hospital, however, said that he reached the conclusion that Adrian was criminally responsible for his actions. He diagnosed Adrian with major depression. Dr. Judith Edersheim echoed this belief, but diagnosed Adrian with avoidant personality disorder and borderline personality disorder. She said that she believed that Adrian did not have a rigid moral code, which was what Dr. Kelly said during his testimony. She noted a 2008 incident when Adrian was arrested for drunk driving, an instance when he smacked the bum of a woman and later urinated on a car. She said that his delusions were fixed on false beliefs and said that in Adrian's manifesto, he acknowledged that no physical assault had happened, but instead wrote that Lisa had raped his mind. After 7 days of testimony, the jury were sent away to deliberate. After 2 days, they reached a verdict.
Is he not guilty? Not guilty, lack of criminal responsibility, guilty first-degree murder, guilty second-degree murder, or guilty manslaughter?
Guilty first-degree murder.
They found Adrian Loya guilty of first-degree murder. Anna was given the opportunity to give a victim impact statement. Turning to Adrian, she said, "Yes, we begged and pleaded to be spared, for the nightmare to be just that. Once my body was shot all of those times, Lisa got to hear that she was loved. She got to feel my lips on hers before she took her last breath. She wasn't alone. She was loved. She felt love." Anna described how she suffered from PTSD, anxiety, and depression, and had to move away from the home she had shared with her wife because of the impossible memories, both of what her life could have been and the terrifying night of the attack. Lisa's mother, Virginia Berlanga, told a story about how Lisa had invited Adrian over for Thanksgiving dinner with her family because she had felt bad that he had nowhere else to go. Speaking directly to Adrian, she said, "That was our daughter. You were a co-worker who she invited because you had nowhere else to go. We thought that you were a friend." Officer McDonald also made a victim statement. He said, "I am no longer a police officer because of Mr. Loya. I no longer walk proudly in uniform. I walk in pain, sometimes with the label of handicapped." Adrian was sentenced to life in prison. As he was being led to a van outside the courthouse, he had a few words to say to the media who had congregated outside.
"Mr. Loya, what do you say to the victim's family?"
"I'm very, very sorry."
With Adrian removed from the courthouse, Lisa's sister, Lori Ruse, and the rest of the family recalled fond memories of Lisa. She said, "This incredible pain I feel, isn't something that becomes more bearable as time passes. The mercy that he has been granted is that he is still alive, and my sister is not.
A very sweet family, a very loving family. When Lisa's mom hugged me, I wasn't quite sure that she was going to let go. You could just feel her heart was broken.
When it comes to mental health and culpability, juries can be walking on a thin line. Over the course of 4 years, Adrian Loya had been plagued by an obsession that transformed into stalking, nightmares, panic attacks, and a hatred that seemingly consumed every aspect of his life. Following the trial and verdict, Adrian admitted that he was not the victim of a sexual assault, stating, "Lisa never really did anything that bad to me, and it is because of how my mind is wired that her actions seemed horrible. I now believe the Coast Guard, in their own special way, tried to help by not doing anything. I escalated it because I was too stupid and naive to leave it well enough alone. And look what it got me." Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporter, Elizabeth Byers. I am eternally grateful for the support. If you'd like to support the show in return for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, ad-free episodes, early release episodes, polls, and loads of other cool stuff, then please check out Morbidology on Patreon or Himalaya Plus. The links are in the show notes. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Ratings are an easy way to support a podcast that you like. Big thanks to everybody who has simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode. I really do appreciate all of the support, and I am eternally grateful. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Military Murder. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
You may have been watching the news and keeping an eye on the Vanessa Guillen case out of Fort Hood, Texas. Well, Military Murder is a podcast about cases just like this. Murders that occur around the world at the hands of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and sometimes even veterans. In addition to extensive coverage of the Vanessa Guillen case, Military Murder recently featured an unsolved murder case out of North Carolina. Get this. During Memorial Day weekend this year, 8 soldiers went camping, but only 7 returned home. The 8th soldier's partial remains washed ashore 6 days later, and his death was ruled a homicide. The case involves a sketchy 911 call with conflicting information by the friends, and a $25,000 reward offered by Army investigators looking for the public's help. New episodes of Military Murder are available every Monday wherever you listen to podcasts. And with a backlog of 40 episodes, there is plenty of content for you to binge. Now go on, subscribe and listen to Military Murder.